One of the points that also arose during the conference, that the more conflict, the more instability, the better for the corrupt, really.
Welcome to Kickback, everybody. I'm Liz David-Barrett from the Centre for the Study of Corruption at the University of Sussex, and I'm delighted to be joined today by two guests who are with me to discuss particularly the topic of corruption as a national security issue. And my two guests are Greta Fenner, who is the Managing Director of the Basel Institute on Governance. Hi, Greta.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for having me.
And Daniel Erickson, who is the CEO of Transparency International. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'm going to start with Greta. But actually, you know, one of the reasons for having you both here is that you've both just come from the Munich Security Conference, where corruption has been one of the key topics that's actually been discussed. So I wondered, actually, Greta, could you just explain to listeners to start with, what is the Munich Security Conference? What happens at it? Who's attending it? You know, what's its purpose?
Thanks, Liz. I'm not a specialist on the Munich Security Conference, but it is certainly the international gathering, I would say, or forum, at least for the Western world, if I can use that outdated terminology, to debate pressing international security policy issues. It's quite a gathering. I would say there's probably about 2,500 people who were there this year. And you have everything from heads of state, many, many ministers, very senior members of, you know, in other government positions, policymakers, diplomats, a couple of civil society people like Daniel and I think that's roughly it. It's quite an interesting setup because it's held in an old hotel in the middle of Munich. So what it means is these 2,500 people are really crammed together in a very narrow space, which makes it very, very private. And you do, you know, it does happen that you walk right past the head of state and can actually even potentially engage with them. So it's quite a fascinating environment, you know, to discuss security issues. Just maybe one point in terms of how you introduced the question, I wouldn't necessarily say corruption was a key topic at the Munich Security Conference, but there were more sessions, and Daniel can probably talk more about it. He's been there more often than I have. There were more sessions on corruption, including the one that I was moderating and conceptualizing, which was part of the main program, as opposed to in the past, there were kind of side events, you know, that crowd, you know, looking for a small space in the basement of the building. And now we were on one of the main stages. So that's probably a positive development.
I mean, that's actually, I think, an interesting thing to pick up on, perhaps, with Daniel. So, I mean, Daniel, as head of Transparency International, is the Munich Security Conference something that, you know, the head of TI always attends? And, you know, how has it got onto their agenda?
Since it's taking place in Munich, it's always been in our interest to be present there. It's a train ride away from me. But it's also, as Greta said, it's a very high-level event. And it's probably, since it's not traditionally or at all focused on corruption, it's an event where you will find high-level individuals from all parts of government and business as well. And it's a very good venue for me to raise the issue of corruption and anti-corruption. TI, well, I have attended events since I stepped into the role of CEO. Which is now 4 years ago. Immediately after the pandemic, I started attending it. And before that, the TI Germany did attend, but it's a very difficult event to get into. And just as to build on what Greta said, 4 years ago when I started, it was actually quite difficult for me to get a pass to get into the room, so to speak, with the heads of state. But now we as TI was one of the few civil society organizations that actually had two representatives, me and Kay, our vice chair of the International Board of TI, present in the event. And as Greta said as well, in the past, there used to be one closed room event on anti-corruption, invitation only, which I was part of. Now I'd say that at least half a dozen or more events were taking place open to all participants of the event that touched upon the topic of corruption, anti-corruption, and strategic corruption was definitely high on the agenda. Although it was not a focus, but the fact that they recognize it as a topic, I see as a huge progress.
So it's definitely something that has moved up their agenda. I mean, just looking back on this, I think the first time I came across someone talking about corruption as a national security issue, I think Robert Rotberg did a book on it, and then of course there was the Sarah Chase book, Thieves of State. But it was still, that was very much sort of a new thing to see corruption as a national security issue. Greta, how did you sort of come to think about it in these terms, and why do you think it is now being framed in that way? Where's that come from?
Well, I do think that generally speaking, the illegal invasion of Russia into Ukraine was probably a trigger why globally now we have a lot more attention to the issue of strategic corruption. I don't think it's a new topic. It's just that's the event which I think really, brought it to the forefront and in a sense made it so that we couldn't ignore it anymore or high-level politicians couldn't pretend it doesn't exist. It's been existing, ever, I don't know, maybe since humanity exists. I don't know, because it seems to be a human trait to try to corrupt others to gain power or in various forms and not only personal benefits, although power usually is personal benefit as well. I think that personally, why I care about the topic is obviously because our world becomes a lot more complicated geopolitically, and you can't help but understand that corruption does play a key role, but also maybe more because I'm a bit tired of talking to my own bubble so much, and because I think our own bubble alone really can't resolve the world's biggest problems, unsurprisingly. And so, generally speaking, at the Basel Institute, we have as a strategic objective to engage with other communities that have close ties to ours and where we feel there isn't enough collaboration, there isn't enough coalition building, and there isn't enough mutual understanding. So, certainly, we started with the environmental space, for example, a few years back, and security, the security community in that sense is another very closely related community where I think there is a huge need for more engagement beyond empty words, but really action. I mean, we really need to understand each other better. I was also organizing an event with at the Basel Peace Forum on the similar topic, also with TI and others, Ukrainian speakers and so on represented. And that's the other side of the security side, of course, is the peace community. And that's, part of the same community that we're trying to reach out to. And we can maybe talk about that later in the sense that, corruption really also needs to be considered in peace negotiations, peace mediation processes, because that is part of trying to get, resolve conflict. And it can go really well or it can go really badly and kind of reinforce conflict as well.
Yeah, Daniel, obviously TI has had a defense and security program for many years. So it has definitely been something that's been on the organization's agenda. How did you come to it personally? And could you say anything perhaps about, what's the implications of framing it as a national security issue? Does it change then the way that you do advocacy?
Yeah, well, starting with your second question, I think it's very important because, I mean, last year when I attended the MSC, I had meetings with several parliamentarians, I wouldn't say which country, but they told me in conversations that we had that they didn't see corruption as a problem at all. They saw corruption as equal to petty corruption, and that petty corruption was a problem of the global south, and that corruption had no reasons to be discussed at a forum like the MSC. And that to me shocked me. Which actually led to me and Greta having a discussion on what can we do in order to get attention to our topic, and that ultimately led to Greta moderating a panel on one of the main stages on the topic this year. So it being seen as a national security threat gets people out of that bubble of it being a financial impediment to sustainable development, which it is as well, but when it is a threat to freedoms and democracies, it also becomes a topic of the global north, which people for some reason forget in this day and age of Qatar Gate, Azerbaijani laundromat. I mean, the list is long and only growing all the time. And it's high time that liberal democracies, the countries that are sitting on the top quarter of the CPI, actually do something about this new form. It's not a new form, but this re-emergence of a type of corruption that has been around for ages.
Greta, did you want to come in there?
Yes, just something that Daniel said also made me think about the challenges that I was speaking about to bringing these communities together and working together. I think we in the anti-corruption community, and I realize it every time I talk about this topic, also need to think about what we mean when we say corruption is a national security risk. Because, of course, most people would think of the sort of small bribes or the big bribes, whatever, you know, the financial transactions, which Daniel referred to as part of the issue, but not all of it. And ultimately, I think someone wrote to me in notes on this issue, not everything we don't like is corruption, not everything we might call corruption is illegal. So we have to talk in a more sophisticated way about what we mean. So it's also about using influence. It's about a very, very long-term game, especially when you talk about strategic corruption, very subtle ways of undermining systems through corruption or corrupt forms of executing power, etc. But it's just the challenge with bringing these two topics together is it's really no longer a matter of do you have the right provisions in your criminal code, because it's not that anymore. So most anti-corruption experts, including me, in a way come to our limitations, because that's how we've been speaking about corruption for a long time. We define it in the UNCAC and in our criminal codes, and now, you know, and I think this is the real challenge, why I'm also really motivated to take this topic forward, and about the partnership with, you know, with TI, for example, where I think we need to have a new way of looking at the topic. And that's, you know, that will bring our own community further, I think, but also really the security community, hopefully, if they will listen.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of part in a way of this sort of broader move away from thinking corruption as just a kind of technical issue that can be fixed with technical tweaking of incentives, and thinking about it as much more deeply embedded and political and about power. You mentioned a term then, strategic corruption, a couple of times. And I know, Daniel, that TI has been doing some work on sort of mapping out different aspects of strategic corruption. Could you sort of tell us how you're defining that? What are the different aspects of strategic corruption?
Yeah, and this is a work that is ongoing, and it is a bit of a morphing topic, and it depends on how you look at it. From my own perspective, I see it like, what if I was Putin? What if I was sitting on a bottomless pot of cash, and I wanted to use that cash, that dirty cash, to take over another country, or making another country my vassal? How could I go about doing that? And what we have in our research is three areas that you can group, sort of dissect those efforts into. It is the financial part, where I would use money in order to buy up resources of another country. That could be strategic resources, natural resources, it could be infrastructure, it could be other critically important corporations of that country. But I obviously cannot do that with my name linked to it. So I would have to use the same opaque ownership structures that we see time and time again in our work in order to get control over those critical assets. Then we have the political domain. In that, I would go in and I would either bribe the publicly elected officials, or I would finance their parties, or finance parties that I feel align with my approach of making this country a vassal to my own. Or I would go in if my objective in the political domain might be as to weaken that state as a precursor for something else, to fund parts of society that are anti-democratic or loud outspoken against the current regime or against democracy in that country. My options are quite a lot in that area. But just like in the first bucket, I need to hide my name, and I need to use ways of getting the money to those individuals or those organizations, or if it's not money, it could be training and other forms of support as well, without me being linked to it. It has to be plausible deniability in all of those stages. And the third one, which probably is the one furthest away from our traditional areas of work as the anti-corruption community, that is the social cultural domain, where we have the misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, the use of social media to exasperate the what is being done in the political domain, and push a narrative that is favorable to my own goals. Once again, potentially financing that in country, or using an operation from abroad in order to get my objectives achieved. So That's how
Great, thanks. I think that's actually really helpful. It's a concept that we do hear a lot more now when talking about these sort of transnational aspects of corruption. I guess, one of my concerns about it, and perhaps I could ask Greta to sort of talk about this, is, partly is this anything new? So some of this just sounds like, foreign policy, things that Western powers have done for years to some extent as well. So sort of, what's new about it? And even if it sounds rather pernicious, is it corruption?
I'm going to pass the tricky question you just asked me over to Daniel. No, I'll try to give an initial response. I think it's not new. What concerns me, but what is also why it looks like it's new, or why those who there are certain people who want to make it look as if it was something new, put it that way. We have a world where we are very bipolar again, with a large gray zone in between, of course, which is exactly the gray zone that you can influence through strategic corruption, I think. But it's we're now in a phase where we are seeing the good guys and the bad guys again, and that's frankly what we hear politicians in their speeches say all the time. And the good guys are, unsurprisingly, the West and the so-called democracies, and the bad guys are the rest of the world, where apparently democracy is not functioning, and so on. I would certainly exclude kleptocracies, which are truly, states that are run by corruption, and they are fundamentally bad in every aspect. But I think what I'm worried about is making it sound as if it was something new, and then pinning it on the so-called bad guys exclusively. And you did say, and I agree, to an extent, the same instruments were used by colonial powers in the past. Certain parts of the U.S. government certainly use similar, or have used similar tactics. So I'm very cautious to call it something new. And again, I think it's positive that it's come out more. I know we talk more about it, but because, in my view, the context is the Russian invasion in Ukraine, it is very dangerous that we then start seeing it very black and white and very West against the rest of the world. And that's where I see a real risk. But I'm sure Daniel has a lot more to say on that one.
Well, I don't
Over
know.
to you, Daniel.
Thanks, Liz. No, it is a difficult question. Is it corruption? I mean, in the end, it's subjective on how you see it. It's not new for sure, and it comes with several difficult decisions for us as the anti-corruption community to take, because it is difficult. If you do see it as corruption, it is difficult for yourself to be neutral. I mean, in the past, when we were founded 30 years ago, most of the world was against corruption, and that's what led to the UNCAC and many other great things and great achievements over the last 3 decades. Now, when you see corruption and kleptocracy as something that is a tool of authoritarian states in order to get control of their countries domestically and exert control over countries abroad, then it's a completely different thing. And I'm convinced that we as TI, I keep saying in all gatherings that over the last 4 or so years, we have had more security incidents, more cases of us having to shut down chapters, and more cases where we have to evacuate colleagues from around the world than we've had in the last 30 years. This didn't at all used to be something that we had to think about. And all of a sudden, civic space and security of our staff members has become a central topic for us to be able to operate. Why is that? Well, the world is more insecure, but it's also because corruption all of a sudden is seen as a divisive topic, where you have countries that are very willing to step up and fight petty corruption, to root out corruption from the police and security sector, from the health sector, from the education sector. But at the same time, what we see is that more advanced forms of corruption, grand corruption, is being centralized or more or less monopolized by ruling families or ruling groups, let's say. And a country can look and feel as if it is dealing very well with corruption, but when in reality, it's being centralized at the top. I do see strategic corruption, or whatever name we put on it. I struggle. I mean, strategic corruption is not a good label, I find, but there's not many better ones out there. I certainly see it as a form of corruption, but that also puts us in that difficult seat of having to take sides, which we try to avoid. I mean, we're an apolitical organization. We are for transparency. We are against corruption. But if I then all of a sudden have a growing part of the world using corruption as a means of foreign influence, corruption by our definition, then we have to deal with that.
Yeah, and actually something you just said then made me think, maybe one difference here with strategic corruption now compared to perhaps, foreign policy in the past that might have used some of those kinds of forms of, financial and political influence that you talked about is that we are often talking about very small, narrow interest groups now that are doing this. So, it's not so much the Russian state, it's Putin and a group of people around Putin. So it's much more on that sort of, a capital group that is sort of using and abusing the state power for those, strategic ends.
It could probably be seen as that, that there are small groups, and it's not only Russia. We keep saying Russia all the time, but there's several other countries where this is happening, where the running of the country becomes like a family business, a corporation, where it's all about how can I ensure that I can retain power and how can I get control over those around me so that I build up a system that cannot fall, where the end goal is to secure my own wealth and the wealth of my offspring and those immediately linked to me, a kleptocracy.
Yeah, absolutely. So not really in the national interest, but in a very narrow group's interest. Greta?
I think that's a really important point, actually. I think we are also at a stage where I think in a lot of countries we don't have governments or ruling elites that actually care about the national interest. They really only care about their personal interest, which is why they are letting corruption undermine their strategic partners. They use it to undermine their strategic partners. They use it even to undermine their own governance because they don't govern through the formal governance structures. They govern through the informal governance structures. So a weak formal governance is really convenient, and I think that's one of the points that also arose during the conference, that the more conflict, the more instability, the better for the corrupt, really. But the point I also wanted to make with regards to what you just said in terms of, elites controlling countries, it was clear also when we had the panel in Munich, where we had the president, brand new president, Arévalo from Guatemala, who I provoked a little bit with my first question to him, saying, he came into power and this created a lot of unrest in Guatemala. So coming in on an anti-corruption ticket created insecurity. So maybe we should not do anti-corruption, and maybe corruption is better for stability. That was kind of for obvious reasons, slightly provocative. But it really was shaking the country and the elite of the country that he would win on an anti-corruption ticket. And not far from him, a couple of months earlier, the very promising anti-corruption presidential candidate in Ecuador got killed conveniently a month and a half or 2 months before the elections. And yes, that is probably related to the drug trafficking cartels, in the region. But why do they have such power in the region? Because they can bribe the entire region, as we have also seen in relation to the other break scandal. The entire region is undermined by these cartels through the means of corruption. So it's a slightly different, we're moving away from strategic corruption here, of course, but I think that's a really important aspect of corruption as a security risk as well. Not only, and I think that's perhaps one of the dangers we have to try to avoid, or the traps we have to try to avoid, just because everyone's now looking at Russia and Ukraine and talking about strategic corruption, there's a lot more to be said about corruption undermining stability through, various other forms and not just the strategic form that we refer to now with more or less happiness about the terminology indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked about Ukraine a little bit, but almost as a side issue, as something that has prompted us to think about corruption as a national security issue. Could we just go into it a little bit more for a couple of minutes? So actually, one thing that you said, Greta, when we were chatting at the beginning before we started recording, was that Ukraine defined corruption as a national security issue long before the US. I wondered if you wanted to say any more about that and how that sort of relates to the first round of invasion, etc.
Yeah, I think Ukraine did define it as that, and a few other countries would have defined it or today define it from that region. I mean, Bulgaria, where the prime minister was on our panel as well, really understands corruption as a national security threat as well. I don't know if it's in any strategy, but that's certainly how they understand it under the kind of newish government. And I think it's the experience of these countries formerly part of the USSR and that whole influence region of Russia, now today Russia, that you know, for the last decades, or actually ever since, you know, the end of the, or ever since the early 1990s, various Russian regimes, and for a long time now, Putin's regime, have tried to maintain or regain control over what they thought was rightfully their region, to simplify it a little bit. And they've used corruption. They've had, you know, their oligarchic networks controlling all of these countries by controlling the energy sector and other major infrastructure. And that has been obtained through corruption directly to politicians, to political parties, controlling the media, et cetera, et cetera. I think what really, you know, brings me back to Ukraine is that with the, you know, with the Maidan revolution, the country started to turn away from being, from allowing it to be so heavily controlled through these corrupt oligarchic networks. And that started, I think, to become a threat to Russia's control over the country, because if the country won't allow itself to be undermined through this strategic corruption, well, then, you know, this soft weapon of corruption is no longer as effective. And in a way, at least that's what a lot of Ukrainians say, they feel the first invasion in 2014 was a warning sign to say, yo, this is our country. If you do not continue to allow our oligarchs to control your country, we will become physical. That didn't quite work. And I guess just the success of Ukraine in really reforming itself, they're far from perfect when it comes to corruption today, but they've gone a long, long way in the last 10 years, has really shown Putin and the Russians that they cannot use corruption alone as a way to control Ukraine. And that's when they, you know, that when part of the reason why the invasion, the second invasion, started in 2022. I'm not the quintessential Ukraine expert, but that's certainly what a lot of my colleagues in Ukraine who understand much more about that than I do would say.
Daniel, perhaps I could ask you to sort of, you know, if there's anything you'd like to add on that in terms of how you see it, but also, you know, we often talk about conflict as a driver of corruption. So, given that Ukraine now does find itself in this situation of conflict, you know, what's happened to that anti-corruption movement? Is it possible to keep corruption under control in that kind of difficult context?
I mean, to begin with, I can draw a parallel to Afghanistan. I started my career, by the way, in the military and continued on in the civil society sector in disarmament and in post-conflict reconstruction. And as part of that journey, I worked in Afghanistan. And what I saw in Afghanistan, 2006, I think I was there, was a country where corruption was deeply rooted in society. And it was also used by the government in order to regain or get some kind of control, but it was extremely short-sighted. And as we saw later on, as soon as that inflow of money to retain that corrupt system disappeared, it all collapsed. But up until then, everyone saw corruption as a means to get some money for themselves. And what I see now in Ukraine, and I don't think it's fair to compare Ukraine with Afghanistan, but let's do it for a minute, is a completely different situation where the conflict to begin with is rooted in values, the values of freedom. And as such, the average Ukrainian, the citizens, is seeing corruption as an evil of the past, a taboo that you report on, that you point out, and that is not accepted. It has nothing to do in society. And when it becomes strongly associated with the fight, what you are fighting for, then you can do things that are very difficult to do otherwise. And the fact now that we're seeing one corruption scandal after another, or I wouldn't even call them scandals necessarily, in Ukraine, is not a sign of Ukraine being corrupt. It's a sign of Ukraine having systems and institutions in place to uncover and deal with corruption. In many ways, I would say that is better than your average European country. They are innovative in their use of technology and other tools to ensure that corruption is less likely to happen and that they can find it and bring it to justice when it does happen. And our own CPI, our Corruption Perception Index, highlights that as well, that where Ukraine has done a very positive journey over the last 10 years, whereas most other countries with conflict, they sit solidly at the very bottom of the index. Ukraine is one of those exceptions where through innovation and through perseverance, they managed to climb up.
Well, that's great. And as we sort of start to come to a close, it's really good to have that positive note. Something that that you've both touched on, I think, a couple of times is around how framing corruption as a national security problem opens up new potential partnerships and coalitions. So I just wondered if either of you has any kind of last words on how we sort of move this forward now. So having got that opportunity to frame things, who can we sort of bring into this discussion? What should be our kind of aims there in terms of building broader coalitions? Let's go to Greta first.
I mean, I think first of all, we do need a bit more of this kind of dialogue to clarify words. Although I'm not a great fan of just continuing to talk about things and take action, but I was reflecting. Perhaps what I can see here is I was reflecting coming home from Munich about what do I want from Munich next year? Because after Munich is before Munich, and it was great to have this main program panel, and I do hope we have something similar again. As we were all joking, perhaps more than 45 minutes, maybe 50 or even 60 would be great. But more seriously, that is great, and if we can have that again, that would be wonderful. But what I feel is almost more important is that as the Munich Security Conference or similar conferences shape their agendas and have, let's say, a panel on Sudan or a panel on energy and security or whatever it is, that we will have people with an understanding of corruption, financial crime, strategic corruption, power and influence on these panels rather than a panel on corruption, because it's important to open that dialogue, but we need to integrate how we think and how then we act more instead of having two parallel panels. So I think, I'm just using the image of what I hope to see on the agenda in Munich next year as an image of seeing how we need to start working together instead of just, understanding each other and walking in parallel, I guess. Yeah.
That sounds great. And also, very much that kind of idea of mainstreaming that we've seen in a way with corruption and international development, that we sort of bring it into the conversations about the water sector or the health sector.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Daniel?
I think that we're, as much as this is not new, there is not an established civil society community around this topic. It is still growing, and it's sitting in the intersect of several other topics. It's democracy, it's human rights, it's civic space, and it is corruption. And the fact that it kind of sits in that intersect between a lot of other topics means that we need to reach out to NGOs and actors in those areas. We need to do so more proactively. There is risks until we achieve that, because what we're seeing now as well is that even in so-called liberal democracies, in an effort to address what is seen as city corruption and what I mentioned under the political area of corruption, in other words, the funding of subversive groups or the illicit financial flows into political party financing. There's now actions being taken to shut down civic space or to make it harder to run civil society organizations in certain countries, with the excuse that, well, we are seeing that there is foreign funded groups that are coming in trying to spread propaganda or being part of this strategic corruption tool, and thereby harming our ability as a civil society organization actually to do the good that we're set up to do. And that is a clear risk, particularly once again in liberal democracies. And we see that now in the EU with the Defense of Democracy proposal, which would make our life a lot harder. And we're already seeing it in less democratic countries around the world, following the US Foreign Agent Registration Act of a couple of years ago, where other countries took that as an inspiration and an excuse to come up with other laws that were much more restrictive and then limiting our ability to operate in their countries. So, in summary, we need to reach out and build coalitions with organizations outside of the anti-corruption bubble. And we need to look at corruption through the lens of democracy and basic freedoms.
Thank you both so much. I think this is a really critical topic. It does relate to a lot of exciting themes around geopolitics, but also really difficult themes. And I've really enjoyed being able to think it through with you, and also really appreciate you sort of identifying the sort of risks that this raises in an increasingly polarized world. So that definitely there are some benefits of seeing it in this way, but also we have to be quite sensitive in how we deal with it. Thank you both so much. Great conversation.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you very much, Liz.